Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. As British Prime Minister Tony Blair meets with President Bush at the White House today, with the Middle East at the top of the agenda, Hezbollah expanded its reach into Israel, hitting targets south of Haifa with a new rocket. Israel intensified its air and artillery attacks, crushing houses and roads, killing up to a dozen people in southern Lebanon. The UN is pulling out 50 of its observers. And Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is reportedly due back in Jerusalem tomorrow to begin a second round of diplomacy to try and resolve the conflict. Well, joining us from Jerusalem is Gideon Litchfield, whose most recent article for The Economist magazine posed the question, can diplomacy be given a chance? Welcome, Gideon, and that is a good question, especially given everything that's been happening today. First, what's behind Rice's quick return?
I don't know. I mean, I can only assume that they are looking now at talks with with the Israelis over what might be an acceptable diplomatic solution. I think what's been going on in the last few days, even though the Rome conference didn't look very promising, essentially no agreements were reached, I think it looked like a step towards, or the first step towards some kind of diplomatic solution. And Israel, as time has gone by in this campaign, has had to adjust its expectations. Criticisms are beginning to be voiced to the military campaign. Israel may be looking itself for some way out at some point, and so maybe we're actually seeing the first bits of a diplomatic solution begin to fall into place.
Well, remind us, if you will, perhaps we can call the roll. What do each of these major players want? The U.S., Israel, Lebanon, Syria?
Well, let's see. Israel obviously wants Hezbollah. Ideally, it wants it disarmed completely and pushed back away from the border. The majority of the Lebanese government would probably not be unhappy with the same outcome, but they also they want it to come by in a way that doesn't involve Israel actually continuing to bombard Lebanon, because that seems to be only increasing support for Hezbollah and destabilizing the country as a whole. And the big risk is that if there isn't a diplomatic solution soon, Israel's campaign could cause such destabilization in Lebanon that no solution is possible. Syria is probably looking for a way to come back in, to stop being so isolated. It wants some kind of role. I mean, one of the speculations is that maybe it prompted the Hezbollah kidnapping in the first place in order that it might have some kind of mediating role. But I think one way or another, it wants to be a player in finding some kind of solution. The U.S., well, I don't know. I mean, the U.S. obviously is looking to avoid this turning into another policy failure after what's going on in Iraq. It probably would like to see a solution in which some kind of international monitoring force is brought in, and at the very least to avoid a complete meltdown in Lebanon.
Well, is a ceasefire any more likely now than it was on Wednesday when these folks got together in Rome?
I don't think a lot more. The problem that Israel has is it needs to show a military victory, the government needs to show a military victory to its people, because if it doesn't, it will really lose a lot of credibility. Ehud Olmert is in this position where the prime minister, where he has to prove himself as a man with security credentials, and he has to show that he can defend Israel, in particular since he's planning to withdraw Israeli settlements from the West Bank. He doesn't want a withdrawal from the West Bank to turn into the same thing as the withdrawal from Lebanon did. In other words, Israel vulnerable to attack. So he has to show something decisive. That goal clashes with the idea of a ceasefire immediately, because it would mean Israel looking like it's giving up. And the risk, as I said, is that if they're into ceasefire quite quickly, the effect of the campaign in Lebanon could be A, for Israel to get bogged down have a very damaging campaign for itself, and second, the effect on Lebanon is going to be disastrous.
Just in the 30 seconds or so we have left, one thing that has changed since Wednesday is that some of the moderate Arab leaders who had not been speaking up before to condemn the fighting are now. Why is that happening, and perhaps are they saying one thing publicly and another thing privately?
I think the leaders of the states that are more allied with America, I mean Jordan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, they were very critical of Hezbollah at the beginning, and as you said, they've started to criticize Israel's attack more. And I think that's because popular anger on the street in the Arab world with Israel is growing. very fast as a result of its attack on Lebanon.
We'll have to leave it there for now, Gideon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gideon Litchfield is the Jerusalem correspondent for The Economist magazine. Poker is quickly becoming a new national pastime, with television shows like Celebrity Poker adding to the glamour of a sport where everyone has the potential to get rich quick. But on college campuses, this pastime is turning into an obsession, with students gambling around the clock and some of them becoming gambling addicts. This month, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Internet Gambling Prohibition Act to crack down on the $12 billion cyber gambling industry by restricting the transfer of funds to gambling websites. But will it stop students from betting away their tuition money? Lauren Patrizzi is going into her senior year at Loyola University in Chicago. She got hooked on online gambling after her sophomore year and joins us from Chicago. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you very much for having me.
You say that online gambling has become like a new drug on campus. Is it really that addictive?
It's insanely addictive, and unfortunately there are so many young people who are playing, so many of my friends who are staying up hours of the night, missing class. It's something about being on your computer and the anonymity of it that I think is particularly attractive to college students.
Well, tell us some more about that, particularly how it feels when you're sitting there in your dorm room all alone, probably late at night in front of a computer screen and gambling to all hours.
How do you explain it? I guess it's like you play and you get this amazing high. You're distracted from everything that is around you. You don't know what's going on. You dream about it. You can't sleep. You basically disconnect all other important parts of your life. It's nothing I can even really bring to words how good it feels, but I also can't bring to words how bad it feels after you stop playing.
Certainly bad results for a lot of people. But is that what keeps you going and keeps you alert and excited, is the notion of, well, I may not be winning up till now, but gosh, this next hand could be the one?
It is, and it's so insane how much money you can win. I mean, I would place a $20 bet and end up with $1,200 within an hour and then lose it all very quickly. I mean, that's what's so seductive about it. There are so many poker companies and gambling companies that are advertising to college students. One, because we're strapped for cash, tuition's rising. You know, they've got these advertisements that say, college students, win your tuition. And they're advertising on, you know, college websites or advertising on collegehumor.com. I mean, they know that we're a market that can be tapped.
Well, speaking of money, how were you able to afford it?
You know, I just had some money, like, you know, I had stored away, and, you know, I luckily didn't end up spending all of it, but I spent a good deal. I was an unpaid intern at the time. It was a way, in my mind, I rationalized, oh, maybe just make a few extra bucks and, you know, be able to afford an outfit to go out or maybe pay for a book or something that I'd like to read.
And you were taking odd jobs?
Yeah, really odd jobs, like doing promotional work in the city of Chicago. And it became where I was just taking these jobs to play. And, you know, I wasn't spending time with my friends. I wasn't able to do all those things I should have been doing at that age. And, you know, and the thing is I'm not the only one. There are so many students right now who are probably sitting in their dorm rooms or their apartments and playing.
Well, what made you realize that you had a problem? And how did your parents react when you told them that you did?
I was up late one night, it was like 3 a.m, and I had just finished playing, and I'm like, oh my God, what is going on? I can't sleep, I can't eat, I haven't done anything. I'm just going to write this out. And that's usually how I deal with things, is I just write it out. And one night I just wrote a blog post that I was like, you know, this is a problem, there's so many students that are facing this, this is ruining my life. I mean, and that's honestly how I felt, and I need to get this off my chest. A lot of students have contacted me, you know, through MySpace and other internet portals to say thanks, you know, like, it made me feel like I could say something to my parents or talk about it because, you know, this issue is not being talked about. And, you know, it's really unfortunate because, you know, we get the lessons on drugs and drinking, but nobody ever says the lessons on gambling.
Well, and it certainly sounds as if you put words to an experience that a lot of other people were having but perhaps weren't able to write about. How did your parents react when you told them?
Well, when I called my mom and I said, you know, Mom, I need to tell you something. And, you know, I was so scared she was going to be so disappointed in me. I mean, I was president of my class, good kid, honor student. And, you know, I never got involved with drugs or I have only drank socially. So it wasn't something that, you know, well, could have seen that coming. No, this was like the last thing my parents thought I would, you know, tell them that I had a problem with. My mom was like, what? Gambling? What are you talking about? I mean, I lived on my own, so it was sort of like something I could hide. But it was absolutely the last thing my parents were expecting to hear. But they've been really good, and, you know, I'm working it out and going through therapy, but it's not something I'm ever going to be able to get over. I mean, every addict knows that once an addict, always an addict.
You live near a horse track. But that's not something that was attractive to you. You've been in casinos.
Yeah.
That wasn't attractive. You know, it is an interesting question of what makes this so seductive.
It's nothing like that. I have no desire to go to Vegas. I have no desire to go into a casino. I have no desire to go to the horse track. It does nothing for me. My friends can sit there for 3 hours playing poker at a table, and I'm like, can we please do something else? It's something about the online, the anonymity of it. To hear the chips on the table of the online room, the camaraderie where you get in the chat room, because there's chat rooms hooked up to the poker rooms, it is extremely addictive.
What do you think either colleges or lawmakers should do to curb online gambling by college students?
Well, as a policy matter, I think that it's important that they do something now about the gambling, because all this money is going overseas and our trade deficit is obviously quite large. They don't need a couple more billion dollars going overseas. So as a policy matter, they obviously need to do something there. But colleges definitely need to talk about it, and they're not doing that. And, you know, they need to set up awareness that this is an issue, that this is something like the date rape drug, ecstasy or cocaine. Like, I mean, this is a very, very serious, and it ruins lives. And, you know, they need to start talking about it. They need to have help programs much like that. They have, you know, sexual assault help programs or drug programs or alcohol programs. So first talk about it. Parents need to get rid of the mentality of the not my kid, because obviously that didn't work with me. And lawmakers need to start realizing that, yeah, this is affecting young people.
Do you ever still feel tempted to go back to it?
Absolutely. That sounds so bad, but yes, I am. I mean, it's seductive. I mean, when I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to go out with my friends. I have no money. Oh, maybe if I just sign up one time and, you know, play a quick game and, you know, win $50. Well, I can't do that. Once you play compulsively, there's no turning back. I mean, you can't just go on and play like that. I mean, everybody who's a gambling addict knows that. So it's tempting, but I have goals in my life that I want to accomplish. And I want to do a lot of things in my life. And I know that gambling isn't going to get me there. So keeping that in mind is what's kept me back. But yes, it is a very powerful addiction. And yes, I am still tempted.
Well, good luck in staying away from it. And thank you very much for sharing your personal story with us, Lauren.
Thank you so much.
Lauren Patrizzi will be a senior this fall at Loyola University in Chicago. And up next, we'll find out how widespread the college gambling craze has become and about one student who robbed a bank to feed his online addiction. There's more coming up here and now. Talking today about how online gambling has quickly gained in popularity on college campuses. Matt Schwartz has written extensively about online gambling for the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and he joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Matt, we just heard how one student became addicted to online gambling, but how widespread is it on college campuses?
Pew Foundation just says that there's 1.6 million college students who gambled online in the last year. And then there's another study being conducted by the University of Connecticut that suggests as many as a 1 in 4 of those may fit the diagnostic criteria for being compulsive gamblers. So it's more than a million appear to have done it, and the number of addicts could be in the hundreds of thousands.
You focused on one student in particular, a young man named Greg Hogan Jr., who basically went from a star student to a criminal in a matter of months after he became obsessed with online gambling. Tell us more about him. How did he get started?
He almost has the archetypical story of how a lot of kids get started. He'd seen it on TV, and then he got to school and just started playing some casual games. in his dorm lounge to kind of get to know people for, you know, $5 or $10. And then I think after he'd been in school for a few weeks, someone from his dorm introduced him that, you know, let him know that he could play online. And he thought of it as a game of skill. He didn't really think of it as gambling. And then gradually he started increasing the size of his bets and not telling anyone. And pretty soon he was in over his head.
Well, and did he ever win? Is that what kept him coming back?
Like any game where there's some luck, everyone wins once in a while. And that's often just enough to keep people coming back or thinking that they've nearly mastered it. That's another thing, like kids who are really sure of themselves, like Greg and some of the other students I spoke to, the game almost seems to be harder on them because they think they bring something more to it or they think they can beat it. It's a game that really rewards sort of humility and patience. So some of the same qualities that that get kids into like a top college can get them into serious trouble if they take the same attitude to a card table.
And here he is, the son of a Baptist minister, I believe, who eventually went on to rob a bank to help him pay back some of the money that he was having to borrow to keep on gambling. Was it something about him, or is it something about the online gambling that made him so desperate?
There are millions of students who've, you know, lost something playing online poker, and maybe thousands, say, who have perhaps lost more than Greg, and he's the only one to have robbed the bank. So it's hard to say it was simply the online poker. But as I got to know him and I saw, you know, he's a really nice kid, and there's really nothing else in his background that you can point out as a cause for this, I was kind of forced to come to the conclusion that if it, 5 years ago, if it weren't for online poker, this wouldn't have happened.
Well, and what about the addictive nature of this game? Experts say that the online gambling is more addictive than regular gambling. Why so?
First of all, it's a lot faster than live poker. You're playing, 20 to 30 hands an hour live, and you can play 60 to 100 hands an hour online. You can play 8 tables at once, which, would kick that up to, into the hundreds. You're all by yourself. The money is a lot less real. And then if you're playing in the dorm lounge with people who know you, there comes a point where people will want to quit or people won't feel comfortable taking any more money from you. But that doesn't happen online because you're playing with strangers. They can't see you. They've never met you. And, if they're happy to stay up with you, 20, 36 hours and take as much as you're willing to lose.
New players are often easy prey for more experienced gamblers. There's even software, one program that's called Poker Tracker, that is designed to help find these so-called fish, the new players on the internet. Tell us a little bit more about how that works.
Poker Tracker is a program that a lot of self-described professional online poker players use to sort out who are the new players, who understands the game, and who doesn't. In Texas Hold'em, you get two starting cards. That's how the game begins. And usually you should just fold and not put in any bets. If you're playing more than 40% of your hands, it's virtually impossible for you to win. And any player who's playing that many hands is probably new. So what experts will do is they'll use this software to keep track of people's hands and figure out who the novices are. And then the sites actually have buddy lists so that you can find out what table your novices are at and then chase them around and try and get their money, because it's easier to take money off of the novices than from the other experts.
If you're the parent of a college student, is there any way to know if your son or daughter is getting enmeshed in this until it's too late and they've run up thousands of dollars in debt?
If you have any kind of joint accounts, you can look at the bank statements. That was definitely an early red flag in Greg's case. There were P-Stars withdrawals, PokerStars withdrawals on his bank statements that came to his father's house. But I would just talk to them and try to have an idea of, how much money they have and where the money's going and, how much time they're spending online and what they're doing while they're there. But it's pretty hard for a college student to lose, say, more than $1,000 or $2,000 and not have his parents have some idea.
Although, as you point out so vividly, his parents, even after they became aware of it, tried to intervene, tried to help him. He swore he'd never do it again. And like most addictions, he seemed powerless in the face of it.
Yeah, and I think that's a larger question before Congress right now is, 50 years ago you had to, fly to Vegas, or you had to go to like an illegal, back room, smoky room somewhere on the far side of town if you wanted to, if you wanted to gamble. And now we've reached the point where it's as close as checking your email, and it's, a constant 24 hours a day at every single computer terminal. And, I think it's a question that the Senate's going to address, whether that's something as a society that we really want.
Well, and also, if it's so ubiquitous on the internet now, where might it be heading next?
No, it's interesting you bring that up. They're talking about putting platforms on cell phones, and there's already a few out there that if you have an online poker account, I think you can play it on your cell phone. And that's probably something that we'll be seeing more of in the future.
One more question, Matt. Have you ever tried this?
Well, I played poker live a fair amount before, and I actually thought I was pretty good. But then I really stunk online, and I completely could see how, you know, someone could get extremely into this. You, like, start, and then you look up at the clock, and it's like, whoa, hey, it's 3 hours later. So I had a couple of those sessions and lost a little bit, and then I decided this was probably not something I wanted to keep doing. But, you know, it definitely could have been a problem for me if I were a little bit younger and a little bit, you know, less mature about money. I'm certainly grateful that it wasn't around when I was in college.
Fascinating story, Matt Schwartz. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Gail.
Matt Schwartz wrote about online gambling for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. He spoke with us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBYY.
Here and Now. The British and Irish governments have set November 24th as the final deadline for Protestant and Catholic politicians in Northern Ireland to revive a coalition government, the central goal of the 1998 Good Friday Peace Accord. The process collapsed in 2002 amid spying allegations against the Irish Republican Army, which only last year declared a formal end to its 35-year campaign to rid Northern Ireland of British rule. Confused? Eyes glazing over? Well, it's understandable, because the long and often bloody path to where we are today has been filled with the roadblocks of history, politics, and especially religion. As a brief reminder, the power-sharing government is supposed to bring together some traditionally bitter enemies, Protestants who favor preserving the union with Britain, and Catholics who want a unified Ireland. Well, we're going to wade in once again with someone who can help us sort it all out and give us a snapshot of what's happening today. Peter Hain is Britain's Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. He joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you very much, Gail.
So help us sort it out. You know, to many people, when we think of Northern Ireland, we think of the troubles, the bombings, so many people dead. Thankfully, a different place today, or is it?
It's as night and day compared with what it was. It's dramatically different. You know, we now have more tourists and visitors coming to Northern Ireland than there are people living there. Last year, 2 million came, and there are 1.7 million residents. I mean, that's quite an extraordinary picture of a transformation which is beyond belief from the days when the bombs and the bullets were going off every other day. And now you've got more prosperity than ever before, more jobs than ever before. Belfast is a booming metropolitan city, a great place to visit, wonderful golf courses, Tiger Woods practice for the Open there. So it's really, really transformed. The policing is more widely accepted, the discrimination's ended. And what we need to do now is for the politicians to catch up with all of this or get left behind.
There are still 10,000 or so British troops stationed in Northern Ireland, though. Why are they needed?
Well, they're coming down to 5,000. The watchtowers and the border at South Armagh have been demolished. The troops will be brought right down to the minimum number, and even those remaining will be on standby to go to Iraq and Afghanistan and places like that, not to police the streets of Northern Ireland, where they're not really needed. I mean, the 12th of July marching day, the big day of the parade season, traditionally the source of a lot of community conflict and bitterness and violence, and was the first time in 36 years since 1970 that there was not a single soldier deployed in support of the police to police those parades, because there'd been dialogue across the communities between loyalists and Republicans, between Nationalists and the Orange Order, in order to get agreement that respected each other's positions.
Well, heartening signs to be sure, but are there still some problems with the IRA? Because you said this week that some IRA members are still involved in criminal activities.
Overall, and it's not me saying this, although I repeated what the Independent Monitoring Commission report said in April, And all the evidence is that that's being borne out in the ensuing period, in the run-up to their next report in October. They're a group of independent experts, not under the control of any government. They call it as it is. They said the IRA had ended its paramilitary activity, completely closed it down. They'd stopped criminal operations, and at a leadership organized level, they were seeking to stamp out every last aspect of criminality. But what it also said, and I've repeated, is some individuals who are members of the IRA or were members of the IRA are indulging in criminality for private gain. So it's not a picture of perfection. And I don't know that it ever would be, any more than it's possible to say we've got no crime in the cities and towns of the US. There's always problems to be solved, but at least they're the problems of a normal society, or an increasingly normal society, not the abnormal, conflict-ridden horror that people used to live in 10, 20 years ago.
Are you frustrated then when you hear someone like the unionist leader Ian Paisley, who says that compromise with Catholics will be done over our dead bodies? I mean, does he still represent some significant public opinion, or is he simply saying the same things that he's been saying for quite some time?
Well, both. He's saying exactly the same rhetoric that he's often deployed. I'm not sure it's terribly significant, to be perfectly honest, in the heat of the moment on the stump on the 12th of July. I don't know that any people really thought it was in any sense significant. But he does lead the largest party, not just the largest unionist party, but the largest party, and therefore he's a very important figure on all this, and he will be pretty decisive as to whether we get a power-sharing executive up and running or not. And my message to everybody, to not just his DUP party members, but also to the rest of the politicians there, is it's really time they made their minds up. Do they want to do their jobs or don't they? By the time November the 24th comes round, they'll have been out, the Assembly will have been suspended for 4 years. Now, you can't keep doing this. I mean, Northern Ireland, as I was describing earlier, is becoming increasingly normal, more and more prosperous. People are going about their lives, are turned off the politics, unfortunately, more and more. And the politicians have to get real and catch up and decide whether they want to do what politicians in every other part of the world want to do and exercise power with each other. Or else they'll leave it to us to continue to do it. Myself, as a British direct rule minister, Secretary of State, together with very, very close cooperation with Dublin and the Irish government, something that wasn't the case in the past. We're now joined at the hip in taking forward a common agenda for the whole island of Ireland, and we'll get more of that. And the question is, are the locally elected politicians going to do what I think the people want them to do and settle their differences and put aside their past bitter enmities and do the business?
As you say, if things are getting so much better on their own anyway, will a coalition government really make any difference?
Well, I'm a believer, and I guess most of your listeners would be, in democracy, in the people deciding who should represent them, and if they don't like what they do in government, kicking them out. Nobody in Northern Ireland can kick me out, because I'm appointed by the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, and I am accountable to the voters of Great Britain, and in particular the voters of Wales, where my constituency is. So they're the ones to whom I'm accountable. And it's better if you have locally accountable politicians. That goes without saying. But if the politicians won't do what every other politician the world over wants to do and exercise power, well, I can't force them to, and I wouldn't try. And my message to them really is that they're not doing me a favour. They're not doing the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, a favour. They're not doing Bertie Ahern, the Irish Prime Minister, the Taoiseach, a favour by meeting the deadline of November the 24th. They're doing themselves a favour.
Will it be a wonderful day, though, for the British government when Ireland is at long last in charge of itself? What does the British government have to gain by that coming?
We do want to see it happen because we think it's the right thing. But if it doesn't, we'll continue cooperation across the border with Dublin on economic matters, energy matters, sharing hospital facilities. So we'll do all of that.
Peter Hain is Britain's Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. You're listening to Here and Now. Peter Hain, you just said that cooperation between Britain and Ireland will continue, but specifically, what do you think will happen if Catholic and Protestant politicians in Northern Ireland are not able to come together before November 24th?
Well, it'll be very disappointing and very, very sad, and the danger for them is they could write themselves out of the script in the future, because direct rule ministers like myself will continue to exercise the power that we are and drive through reform programs. We will work increasingly closely across the border with the Republic of Ireland's government, and more you're looking at companies who are trading across the border. In a sense, the border, if you cross the border now, you almost don't know you've done so, except that there are kilometre signs on the roads in the Republic side, and there are mile-per-hour signs on the Northern Ireland side. And life, you know, is in a sense going past the politicians, and it's important that they don't, as I say, write themselves out of the script, but catch up fast.
It is an interesting thought that the troubles have gone on for so long. For many people, the troubles will always be this bitter memory. But have most people simply gotten tired of it, simply want peace, simply want to move on with life?
Well, I think they want peace, and they've got peace with, it's not perfect, but they've got peace. They want to get on with their lives, and life is quite good for most people in Northern Ireland now, better than it's ever been. They're more prosperous, and there are more jobs. It's not to say there aren't still divisions and there isn't still a lot of sectarianism around, far too much prejudice around. There is still all of that. You can't wipe that away overnight, even in the few years that we've had. We're talking about centuries of argument and conflict and division. I do think people are increasingly realizing, especially young people, that they want to get on with their lives. The politicians, I think, have a very interesting choice to make, because either they're going to make sure devolution works, devolving power to the executive in the Northern Ireland Assembly and restoring the Assembly itself, or they're going to say that the Assembly is going to go into deep freeze. And that's a big, big decision for them to make, with big consequences for what their own future as politicians is. I think the future of Northern Ireland is safe and secure, but it would be much healthier and more secure if it was under democratic local control.
I, for a very long time, looked at Northern Ireland and thought, they are simply never going to be able to solve this one. It just goes too deep. The hatred is too omnipresent. It is too bitter. And I wonder, now that things are so much better there, whether you take a lesson from this when you look at the Middle East, might the same idea apply, that one day, in the same way that Northern Ireland became peaceful, that the Mideast might become peaceful as well?
Well, I do think that's where history will lead us, because there isn't really an alternative. And that's been true of Northern Ireland, and indeed the whole island of Ireland, and it's got to be true of the Middle East as well. Now, how we get there and how we overcome the present awful carnage and tit-for-tat killing that's going on in the region is another matter. But you look at places that have transformed themselves, South Africa, for example. Who would have said, you know, I was brought up in South Africa, my parents were involved, as I was subsequently, in the anti-apartheid movement and put in jail and so on. And we would never have thought 20 years ago that Nelson Mandela could have walked out of prison and become president 4 years later. This was a kind of miracle, but it happened. And it happened because it had to happen. And Northern Ireland's journey from conflict and war and terrorism and some of the most brutal, degrading violence that humankind has ever seen to where we are now, when that isn't happening, was in a way a torturous journey, but an inevitable one, really. And the same was true for South Africa. I think the same is true for the Middle East. You've just got to believe in the triumph of human spirit over all of this barbarism.
Peter Hain is the British Secretary for Northern Ireland. Mr. Hain, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Ventriloquism is generally thought of as an art form that has had its day, long ago. The word alone evokes vaudeville stages, Señor Wences on the Ed Sullivan Show, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Yeah, my name is Charlie McCarthy. What's yours?
Vicky.
Oh, that's cute.
Charlie.
Vicky, Mr. Bergen, Vicky.
How do you do?
How do you do? You know, ventriloquism has always fascinated me.
It has? Well, I'll be glad to explain it for you.
Well, I'd love to know, but really, I must find...
Oh, please stay. It'll just take a minute. Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, ventriloquism, it starts here and goes up here.
And it comes out here.
It comes out there, yes.
Well, decades later, Edgar and Charlie were still at it on The Muppet Show, and then came soap. For 4 years, a top-rated TV series with the mildly schizophrenic combination of Chipper Chuck and the wisecracking Bob.
Okay, fine, fine. Don't take me with you tonight.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't go with you to the audition tomorrow.
Come on, Bob. I mean, that could be a big break for us.
No! You want to be alone. Well, you can be alone there, too. We'll just see how your career takes off.
Okay, okay, okay. You can come.
Yeah?
Yeah, but this time, keep your hands off her.
Well, Jay Johnson knows that history like the back of his hand. That hand moved the mouth of Bob the Dummy, with Johnson playing Chuck Campbell. Johnson is telling the story of ventriloquism in a one-man, multi-puppeted show called Jay Johnson, the Two and Only. It's playing to audiences across the country before moving on to Broadway this fall, and Jay Johnson is here with his many voices. Welcome.
Hi, Gil. Nice to be here. How great to hear Edgar Bergen's voice again, you know?
Isn't it?
He had such a great radio voice, and Charlie was such a character. Yeah.
Well, and in fact, it occurred to me that radio has been described as the medium of the imagination. And in this case, people are just going to have to take my word for it that when your characters appear, as they are likely to, you're not going to be moving your lips now,
well,
are you?
Thank you. No, I'm not. I'm not. And I'm glad you're here to testify to that. When Edgar Bergen was first on the radio, it was the Rudy Valley Show. The announcer goes into great detail by saying, this is a man that's in a tuxedo. He's got a top hat. A little man sits on his knee, and it's a monocle. And now we'll watch him as they... And they had to describe what Charlie and Edgar looked like. Much more exciting than television.
Jay, do you think of these puppets, we're told that you do not call them dummies, do you see them as sort of alter egos, alternate personalities? Do they take on a life of their own?
Yeah, they do. And you know, it's spooky when you talk about it in terms of ventriloquism and puppetry and things like that, because it's a personification of a human being. But if this conversation were taking place with Itzhak Perlman, and we're talking about a violin, his instrument, and music that he transcends into, it sounds like an art form. But when you're talking to a ventriloquist, it sounds like a lunatic. That's the difference. So.
What's going through your head when you are talking, when you are being you, Jay Johnson, or in character, and then you also have this character that you are animating that's sitting on your knee or appearing on your shoulder or somewhere close by?
Well, my philosophy on ventriloquism is that I really try to put myself as the observer of what's going on of this little character. And it sounds crazy, but when the puppet is going to say something that I wouldn't necessarily have thought of at that second, and that sounds schizophrenic, but again, an actor can ad-lib in character, and that doesn't sound so crazy, so... You notice that every time I talk about craziness, I try to justify my own sanity. Have you noticed that?
Well, at least you have a good excuse.
Well, I've had a lot of practice at justifying my own sanity.
So the new show includes a monkey, a boa constrictor, yeah. Even a piece of plastic that I guess you draw and create.
Yes, Arthur Drew is his name. We draw him on the board and he comes to life. So
share some of those with us, if you will.
Well, all the characters that are a part of the show kind of exemplify a point in ventriloquism at which it has grown, either with me or historically. We talk to disembodied voices. We talk to all kinds of things. As a matter of fact, let me see if I have a... I don't know if I have a... wait, there's someone over here. Can I just talk to him a second? Hello, Bob.
Hello, Jay.
Can I talk to you one second?
What is it?
Can you come over here a second?
Yes, I will. What is it?
I'd like to meet Gail.
Hello, Gail. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
She's talking to me.
I know. First, it's okay. Yeah. Bob, is there anything you would like to say about the show, The Two and Only?
Only that I think that it's a terrific show, except for that ventriloquist.
Okay, Bob, that's enough for you. Yeah, say bye to Gail.
Bye-bye, Gail. I'll see you later. Okay, see you there.
That was Bob. Now, Bob is my character on Soap, and he is probably the most popular character that I've got, at least the most well-known. I was working with somebody besides Bob before Soap, and they decided to basically recast. And so I was introduced to Bob on the set of Soap the first day. that's not the way ventriloquism is usually done through its life. You usually have a partner and it stays with you early life. But my partner, Squeaky, retired and Bob took over for a while. So,
was that a hard adjustment for you?
Well, it was in some ways, you know. But yeah, the man who created Squeaky was my mentor. He was a great carver. He was a great traditionalist. He was a great man to mentor me in the traditions of ventriloquism. So then to not be able to take the instrument that he created for me and continue on with it was kind of hard to accept.
Yeah, it does sound a little sad, doesn't it?
Well, a little bit, but it worked out. It worked out. So Squeaky is now back in the show, and he's probably one of the best, has one of the best scenes in the show now, so he steals it.
Tell me about your talking houseplant.
Philodendron did not make the cut in this particular show, but Philodendron, and you know, it's not often you know exactly the moment at which you created a character. Usually it's a long process from internally, but I remember a big fan of the Johnny Carson Tonight Show and when Joan Rivers was on all the time. And I guess about the mid-70s, everybody was talking to their plants thinking that was going to make them grow. Several books on it. And I think Joan Rivers came on the Tonight Show and said, I talked to my plants, Johnny, and just the other day one said, shut up, Johnny. And I thought, that's it. That's I want a plant that's fed up.
Back.
That's fed up with everybody, fed up with the music they've been playing. And that became Philodendron, you know. So, but Phil didn't have a place in the show just because it was just one of the many characters I do, and it didn't have a historical or personal perspective other than that story, so.
Well, and I also don't want to steal any of your lines, but I've been reliably informed that your show includes the observation that the devil was the first ventriloquist.
Well, that's what I've been told. The translation has come down to soothsayer or necromancer or one of the other words, but if you go back to the original Hebrew or Aramaic, it's oboth, which means to speak through your stomach, which is the literal translation of ventriloquist. So, yeah, I was told by a group of well-meaning evangelists that I should stop doing what I'm doing because I was in trouble because of the devil. And it's about that little translation of the devil throwing his voice into the snake in the Garden of Eden. Now, if you take that sentence literally, yeah, that sounds like ventriloquism to me, but I've never thought that was a literal interpretation, at least. I hope I'm not going that way.
There are still, to this day, though, people who fear puppets. You know, there's this image of the kind of evil and menacing puppet who comes to life and just, you know, wreaks all kind of havoc and kills people and does all of that. What do you think is threatening about that?
Well, you know, if you really think about it, the story of Pinocchio and the story of Frankenstein are the same story. Here's a creator that creates something that eventually destroys him or makes his life miserable. So I think there's a great fear that man in his creation of something that is human-like is eventually evil and will destroy him. Of course, Hollywood has been great about the Chucky movies. And I mean, I played a schizophrenic on television. I have to claim part of that myself. What I love about the two and only is I love to see the converts, you know, they come in maybe with an opinion about ventriloquism and they leave with a whole different perspective. I don't know anybody that didn't have a doll or a toy or something that they personified, that they wanted to be alive, that they wanted desperately for it to talk back. It's inherent to every human being. And that's what ventriloquism is and always will be.
Well, Jay Johnson, all the best as you head off to Broadway and for all of your shows that happened before then.
Thank you, Gail.
And if you'd like to catch Jay Johnson, the two and only, it's now playing at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and goes to Broadway this fall. You can get more information by going to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Gail Harris. Join us next time for the